Recording. And now, Carl, you can start the meeting.
Okay, so Guy is I don't believe Guy has joined. He warned us that he may not be able to make it because he's in the Sierra Nevadas, I guess on a ski vacation with lots of snow and no computer. So he gave me a few items to go over before we get to our guest speaker tonight. I'll just run through them briefly. Of course, we're all still processing the sudden passing of Jeff Norman, who was our assistant Treasury Secretary for many years and an avid club member here. There's some fine words about his life in the latest Stardust issue. Some words written by Guy and by Jeff's younger sister. Guy and I both went to a memorial service on Connecticut Avenue last month for Jeff. It was actually held in his apartment building in the very meeting room that he had scheduled for our annual meeting last August. So it was a little strange being back in that room memorializing him. There was an overflow crowd, and everybody had good things to say about him. He was a proud Washingtonian, very civic-minded. And when I stood up and said a couple of words representing the NCA, I noticed some friends and family nodding their heads, acknowledging that he was a an avid amateur astronomer. So he'll be missed. The assistant Treasury Secretary position is therefore open, and according to Guy, we appear to have a volunteer to take that position, but we'll know more about that at a later time. And also, I should mention that at the end of my 1 year term in May June timeframe, I'll be stepping aside as vice president. So we'll be looking for volunteers or candidates for both those positions, vice president and assistant secretary treasurer. They're both elected positions, and we'll have our elections at the May meeting. We have speakers scheduled all the way out to October, possibly even November at this point. So whoever takes over this vice president job will have some buffer to work with. There's a tremendous amount of science being done, as you all know, in this area, and especially astrophysics and astronomy, space science. And so it's really fun to keep your eyes and ears open for potential speakers, and it's very gratifying when they do accept the invitation. It's even more gratifying, tonight's speaker, when they approach us first. We'll be having those, we'll be looking for those candidates in the next couple of months. Guy wanted me to mention that the recent daytime solar observing at Great Falls got clouded out, but impromptu sidewalk astronomy sessions, both by day and by night, at the corner of Connecticut Avenue and Calvert Street, Northwest in D.C., were great successes. People, Guy says, people are so happy in all caps, and grateful to be able to see the sun and H alpha, and to see the amazing array of planets. Lastly, I should mention, or Guy wanted me to mention, that we now have several telescopes that have been donated to NCA, 4-inch refractor, a 6-inch and 12-inch Dobbs, and an 8-inch SCT. We could either sell them or keep them as loaner scopes that any member could check out. And he has a few more words in the Stardust write-up about the possibility of having a checkout program for club members. So that's what Guy wanted me to mention. That's all I have to mention. If does anyone else have any very brief comments to make at this point? Okay, I don't hear anybody. I think I'll just move on to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Matt Clement, who received his undergraduate degree from the Naval Academy in 2010. And after spending several years in the Navy, in particular 3 years on board the fast attack submarine USS Topeka, he started his graduate career at the University of Oklahoma in 2015, and then received his PhD from that university in 2019. Did a stint, a postdoc stint at Carnegie Earth and Planets Laboratory here in D.C. That's in Northwest D.C., right, Matt?
Yeah, like right on the Chevy Chase boundary, kind
Online,
of.
yeah. And is currently a research scientist at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, the famous APL. So before I turn it over to you, Matt, I just wanted to ask you about this one line in the bio you forwarded to us. Spent a year during your PhD studies, you spent a year in Bordeaux, France, as a Chateaubriand graduate fellow. Bordeaux Chateaubriand sounds like a really great meal to me.
It was a really rough year.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, it ruined us for, and we can't buy American wine anymore. It was a really, really tough experience.
Were you right in Bordeaux or were you in the countryside?
We were like right in Bordeaux. My wife and I, she quit her job. We moved out and we rented like a tiny apartment that, you couldn't even hardly stand up in. Right in the center of the city. It was the best decision we made. And I took the tram out to the university, which is like farther out of the city every day. It was great.
I
Just
assume you
traveled
got
all around.
yeah, I assume you got around to some of the wine country,
Oh yeah. Learned very little French through the process.
right? Okay, so Matt's talk tonight is entitled Planet Formation at Home and Abroad. So go ahead, Matt.
Right. I guess I should have put this slide up. I did put a quick slide together, a background on myself. I guess I should have put this up while you were reading the bio. But yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's always really fun to talk to, anyone who's interested in astronomy. And I'm sure lots of stuff I'll talk about, all you probably know about or might know more than me about. So feel free to, I have a lot of slides put together, but we can get through as few or as many as we have time for. Feel free to interject, ask questions, and stop me at any point. So yeah, I spent a little time in the Navy before going into astronomy. One of the cool things I got to do during that time was on a submarine, and we did a under ice run. We surfaced at the North Pole, which is what those pictures are there. And yeah, it was in the middle of December. It was like minus 60 degrees, pitch black the entire time. And the ship systems manual specifies that you're not supposed to surface through any more than 18 inches of ice. And as you can see from those pictures, we went through just a little bit more. It was something like 7 to 8 feet. We bounced off a couple times trying to get through. Originally, I'm from California and kind of have found myself on the East Coast for, pretty much the entire time since high school through the Navy and then, coming out here for work. Today I'll mostly talk about planet formation, but I'm kind of a planetary dynamicist. I work mostly with orbital dynamics. So I've also, in addition to like kind of the stuff I'll talk about today, worked on a lot of stuff, kind of more solar system dynamics type problems. So I'll talk today more about planet formation, the formation particularly of the solar system's terrestrial planets. But I've worked a lot on the, how the eccentricities and inclinations of the giant planets evolved to their current state. A lot about the, the distribution of orbits in the asteroid belt, and I've worked a little bit on formation of exoplanets too. And right now, at the lab, I'm kind of 50% my own grant-funded science, and then 50% I work on some modeling for the Space Force to help pay the bills. Kind of the ongoing projects I got now, I'm working a lot on the formation of the giant planet satellite systems, and then I'm doing some work to improve how we model collisions in the N-body integrators that we use to study planet formation. So that's a little bit about me. So let's talk about the solar system, and let's talk about solar system formation. And I'll go a little bit through the history of it, just because I think it's interesting, and I think that I mean, some of you might already know all this, but I think this audience might appreciate a little bit of the background of the history of how we've built up to modeling the formation of the solar system. And as I mentioned, I work mostly with orbital dynamics, and the most important thing in orbital dynamics is mass. And it turns out that's also one of the biggest, most important constraints on our planet formation models. You got to get the mass right, and getting the mass right in the solar system's tricky business, right? Because there's some big, large deltas in mass as we move through the solar system. Even in the inner solar system, right? Earth and Venus are about the same mass, but Mercury and Mars are, 10% or less of that. Mercury is only 5% the mass of the Earth. Turns out that's kind of hard to do. Nature doesn't want to form things that way. At least that's what our models tell us. This just kind of tells us that something might have happened there. The asteroid belt is a problem too. There's not a lot of stuff there. There are a lot of asteroids, but if you add them all up, that they add up to less than the mass of the moon. It's something like 0.01% the mass of the Earth if you add up all the asteroids. So how did we get so many of them? And why are they so, is it so devoid in mass? And why didn't any planets form in the asteroid belt? These are, big problems that people still work on. We have potential solutions. But these are certainly all, big matters of debate in the field today. And then you move out to the giant planets, and these things are, between, 14, 15 times the mass of the Earth for Uranus and Neptune, up to like 300% the mass of the Earth to Jupiter. So, Jupiter and Saturn, between them make up like 99% of the mass of the solar system that is not in the sun. So they're very important dynamically. So they govern a lot of how the orbits evolve in the solar system today, and a lot of how everything evolved when the solar system was forming 4.5 billion years ago. And you move out, to the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud. There's actually a lot more mass out there than even in the asteroid belt. And so one of the biggest problems there is, everything's so diffuse, right? So how are you able to grow these relatively large objects that, but there's only, there's only an Earth mass worth of stuff for, a parsec or so today. So these are, kind of an overview of the big problems in planet formation in the solar system. We'll get into more detail. But going back, like, how did we get here? How did our models of planet formation in the solar system evolve to today? So going back to the time of Galileo, this is what the solar system that Galileo knew about. As people were starting to develop the key important theories of modern physics, the solar system was an important problem, right? This is what, it's what Newton and Kepler and all them, this is what they thought about. And this is what they had to go off of, right? So just kind of the six inner planets, and then, comets and meteors and a few moons. This is all that they knew about. So what came, kind of, I think, most important for, the beginning of the development of theories of planet formation in the solar system was the proliferation of national observatories that happened through like the 1700s into the 1800s. And it's kind of evidenced by this great pretentious quote from William Herschel here. You weren't cool as a country unless you had a big national observatory. And the astronomers that worked at these observatories, right? They the key, most important thing that they did for planet formation is the discovery of more planets in the solar system. And through that process, that's how our understanding of orbital dynamics was refined. Our understanding of all the bodies in the solar system was refined. This is how all this stuff really started going. So what I wanted to highlight is kind of the first theory of what makes the solar system tick. You might have heard of this before, the Tidius-Bode law. Made up by Johann Tidius, who was a professor in Germany, and Johann Bode, who was head of the National Observatory in Berlin for like 30 or 40 years or something. So this is just a simple power series that they use to kind of explain the orbits in the solar system. And so they kind of figured out if you take this, you take Mercury's distance from the sun, its semi-major axis, and you add 0.3 to it, you get where Venus is, 0.7 AU. And then if you add 0.3 again, you get to where Earth is, 1 AU. If you add two 0.3s, you get to about where Mars is. And if you keep that series going, you get to where all the other known planets were. So this led to, you might have heard, the prediction that there should be a planet at 19 AU and another one at 2.8 AU. And lo and behold, about 20 years after they came up with this, William Herschel discovered Uranus right where it was supposed to be. So there was like this 20-year period where there was a big ongoing search to fill in that last unchecked box at 2.8 AU. There should be a planet there, right? This is our theory of planet formation. Everything follows along with this series. And sure enough, no pun intended, the series was completed when Ceres was discovered in like 1801. And the Tidius-Bode law was vindicated again. It was at 2.8 AU, right where it was supposed to be. And the initial, they only had it for a little bit, and then they lost it, and it was recovered, like 6 months or a year later. The initial estimates on the size of this thing was like the size of Mars or so. We know now Ceres is a lot smaller, but like, boom, you've got the whole series here. And if there's something else, where should it be? It should be at 39.9 AU if you continue the series on out. Well, that all fell apart, obviously. You all probably know this. Discovered a whole bunch of asteroids in the 10, 15 years after Ceres was discovered. So something else is going on in the asteroid belt. We got to figure that out. And Neptune, of course, is not at 40 AU, it's at 30 AU. And it wasn't discovered because of the Tidius-Bode law. It was discovered because its mass was inferred to explain some of the perturbations on Uranus's eccentricity that they couldn't explain just from forcing from Saturn. So by 1846, we have the whole solar system, and we're living in an interesting time now, because for 150 years after we had the whole solar system, all the known planets, all of our models of planet formation kind of took the solar system, as the truth of what all planetary systems must look like. And we had a very, very solar system focused view of the process of planet formation. Small planets like the Earth, small rocky things form close to the sun. Big giant planets form far from the sun. And with the discovery of exoplanets in the past 30 years, we've kind of had to throw out all of our, planet formation theories that were developed. Not all of them, but we really had to reevaluate our very, very solar system centric view of planet formation, because the majority of systems, I'm sure, you've seen many, many other exoplanet presentations, that the majority of systems don't look like us. This is a plot here. Many of you've probably seen before. This is a plot of a bunch of exoplanets. This is, you could plot this in a whole bunch of different ways, and you kind of see these same big populations come out. So you're looking at distance from the central star on the x-axis and the mass of the planet on the y-axis. And if you put our giant planets on this plot, you see the red points, a lot of the RV discoveries, we find things that look like our giant planets. It's giant planets with long orbital periods, but it turns out that's not even really the most common type of giant planet. There's this other population of giant planets, the so-called hot Jupiters, that have short orbital periods. So if you know, we have looked at enough stars and searched for exoplanets around enough stars now to kind of have a somewhat unbiased take on what fraction of systems look like our own. It turns out that the fact that we have giant planets with large semi-major axes far from the central star, around about a solar mass star with low eccentricities, very circular orbit, that's pretty rare. The majority of these other giant planets on with long orbits like our own have very, very eccentric orbits, eccentricities of like 50%, 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, 0.8. Jupiter and Saturn have a little bit of eccentricity. That's important. But the compared to all these other systems, their orbits are effectively circular. Then we go to the terrestrial planets, and we can't really detect these things yet around other stars, though we're really getting there. We can't detect things, in 300-day orbits, the mass of the Earth or the mass of Mars. So our plot is not particularly populated down here, though we think these things are there. But what the solar system doesn't have might be a little bit more important. It does not have this third population, these things that are somewhere between the size of Jupiter and Saturn and the Earth, or sorry, between the size of the Uranus and Neptune and the Earth, these so-called super Earths and sub-Neptunes. These are things, with radii 1.5 to 3 or 4 times that of the Earth, masses less than about that of Uranus and Neptune, but more than the Earth. And the majority of them are on these very, very compact orbits, more compact than Mercury's. And what's significant about these is, again, the fact that we don't have one. And it turns out that the majority of systems do. The estimates on the fraction of sun-like stars that have one of these things, one of these super Earths on very short orbits, is depending on, whose paper you believe. It can be as up to as much as 50%. So it's significant. The solar system doesn't have one of these. So to kind of summarize from a planet formation perspective, what some of the oddities of the solar system when looked in the context of, as kind of as being shown here, the spectrum of different systems that we've discovered. So there are a whole bunch of different planetary systems, multi-planet systems that we've discovered and observed, plotted here with the size of the planet scaled by its mass, the size of the point, the distance from the star, and the x-axis. None of these things look like the solar system. There's a couple that if you squint, it's a giant planet with a super Earth closer to the central star, but the majority of them, are not like the solar system. That doesn't mean there aren't solar systems out there, but it does mean that we went down a different evolutionary path, and it's important to come up with a kind of unified model for planet formation that accounts for all these different things. So the most significant oddities about the solar system are, one, what I just mentioned, that we do not have one of these super Earths. Like all the first 12 or 15 systems here, all the Kepler systems here, these are all super Earths, sub-Neptunes with orbits more compact than that of Mercury. We do not have one. That's significant. We're also one of these rare systems that was able to form giant planets. The giant planet occurrence rate, just in general, for sun-like stars, even down to K dwarfs, the estimates are, in the maybe 10% or so. Again, depending, which paper you prefer, maybe more like 5%, maybe as much as 20%, but it's rarer. And then, the majority of them, again, are not like Jupiter and Saturn, right? A lot of them are these so-called hot Jupiters, these Jupiter mass planets very close to the central star. And also the majority of the ones that are far from their star have these very, very eccentric orbits. And that's again, significant. The other big thing too is if you look at a lot of these systems, a lot of them are, you might have heard this term before. We've referred to a lot of these systems as peas in the pod kind of systems. A lot of it seems that a natural outcome of planet formation seems to be a lot of planets that are very similar in size. And as I talked about on the first slide, the solar system has a wide range of sizes, from the diminutive Mercury all the way up to Jupiter. And again, this is something that the solar system went down some sort of different evolutionary track. So, for the next 6 or 7 slides, I'll kind of try and do a summary of our current state of understanding of planet formation, how we try to account for all these different populations of planets that we observe, and how we think the solar system fits into that picture. What the different kind of evolutionary tracks that nature can take are, and why we went down the one that we did. And then in the final section of the talk, I'll talk about, briefly kind of summarize some of my own research on the topic, particularly work I've done on the formation of the solar system's terrestrial planets. So planet formation starts with star formation. We, are able to, especially now with all these beautiful images that we're getting out of ALMA, we're able to observe this with incredible, resolution. And one of the cool things about all these images that we're getting of protoplanetary disks, and the ongoing tracking of these disks that we've been able to do over the last, 8 to 10 years, is we're able to observe planet formation in its earliest state, through time, from the most newly formed stars and disks, all the way up to the ones that are, presumably birthing planets and moving out of the disk phase. So, when a star collapses and forms to conserve angular momentum, you're going to get this disk of gas and dust that surrounds it, and that is the nursery for planets. Planets, we believe, form in these protoplanetary disks right in the aftermath of star formation, and just the few million years after star formation. So these disks are mostly gaseous, particularly at the beginning. The gas component is about 100 times the mass of the solid component. So in the solid material is mostly dust, which we can see, and we can estimate the mass of with the infrared observations. And we also have a pretty good idea of how long these disks last for. We can look at large clusters of star-forming regions, and figure out their ages from velocity dispersions, and then look at across different aged clusters and see, how many of these infrared excess sources that there are that are birthing planets. And as you get past just a few million years old, these things go away. And we can corroborate that with data from meteorites in the solar system. From the you can tell, what conditions a meteor might have formed in. And after just a few million years of time zero in the solar system, we know these things were not forming in the presence of gas. So the solar system's 4.5 billion years old, and it was in this protoplanetary disk phase for just a couple million years. The best kind of number we have now is like right around that 2 million years, something between 2 and 3. The field's now leaning kind of closer to 2 million years. So now we'll kind of talk about the process of planet formation from the bottom up with this one plot over the next 5 or 6 slides. So on the x-axis, this is time and log scale. So the kind of gray faded shading is meant to show the gas disk phase, and then the disk dissipating around a couple million years. And then we're gonna go, up in mass along the y-axis. So to traverse from the from all the mass, all the solid mass being in dust, to get all the way up to things the size of Jupiter, we have to traverse almost 30 orders of magnitude in mass. And by virtue of its gaseous envelope and its composition of mostly hydrogen and helium, we know that Jupiter had to form within just those couple million years while the gas was around, before it before the solar nebula photoevaporated. So we have to be able to traverse 30 orders of magnitude in just a couple million years. So how do we do that? You can start. Yes, I kind of already talked about that. I'll skip to this one. This makes more sense. Sorry, skip that one. You could start sticking dust grains together as dust is orbiting in the planetary disk, but this is only kind of so efficient. You're as these kind of dust aggregates form, they kind of stick together, and they'll form these kind of little strings of dust, and they kind of hit each other, and sometimes they break up, and you can get up to millimeter sizes or so through this process. We refer to these things as pebbles. Again, these are not like igneous rocks. These are not like pebbles you would pick up at the beach. These are smushy little conglomerations of dust that are they're very fine. You crush them with your hand, and up to millimeter sizes or so, you can stick things together, and you can't get much larger than that because these things are so fragile. So if they get large enough, then they hit each other, they break up. So that's one problem with getting past that millimeter to centimeter size, and we got to get past it because we got to get up to gas giants in just a couple million years. And the other big problem is this: as you start to grow in the protoplanetary disk. Right, you're orbiting, or you're trying to orbit at the Keplerian velocity as a solid object in this big gaseous disk. That's the gas mass dwarfs your mass, and the gas dominates the dynamics, and so you feel a headwind from the gas. You feel this aerodynamic drag force as you are one of these solid pebbles trying to orbit in the disk. So things, depending what size they are, they will feel a more or less efficient drag force, and they'll slowly spiral into the central star. And it turns out what's being shown from this plot from a seminal paper in 1977, the worse size to be is this millimeter to centimeter size, this pebble size, is when this gas drag is effectively most efficient, and you spiral into the central star in just like 100 years or so. So this is what's known as the meter barrier, and this was a huge problem in planet formation for decades and decades. How do you get past this meter barrier? Once we get past it, we can grow things really quick, but it's very hard to take dust and just collide it together and get it all the way up to the mass of the Earth and Jupiter. You get stuck at this so-called meter barrier. So how do we get past this? The way we think we get past it is called the streaming instability. This is kind of the consensus model now for getting past the meter barrier, and you get past it instantaneously. You skip, dozens of these orders of magnitude and mass that we're trying to get past. What is the streaming instability? In essence, it's a runaway process through which we form basically asteroids called planetesimals instantly via gravitational collapse effectively. And the way it operates is trying to be shown by this little cartoon here. Right, so all the little red points are these millimeter centimeter sized pebbles that are drifting inward in the gas disk. And so if you're a little pebble and you're orbiting, trying to orbit at the Keplerian velocity, but not being allowed to do so because you have this drag force from the gas, you're spiraling inward. If you start to encounter a slightly more overdense region, the slightly more solid mass in that region, the gas, the solid material dominates the dynamics slightly more, and you feel a slightly less drag force, and you basically import a back reaction onto the gas, so that the gas orbits, is slightly accelerated. The gas orbits slightly more towards the Keplerian velocity, and you have this runaway process where you drift more pebbles into this overdense region. You know, they slightly accelerate the gas. They orbit slightly closer to the Keplerian velocity, right? So their drift is slowed, as what's being shown here. So as you get into one of these overdense regions, you're drifting slower inward, and you know you're feeling slightly less drag, and it's runaway process, right? So you dump more and more stuff in there until eventually you basically form this filament that reaches the threshold for gravitational collapse, and you directly form planetesimals and these asteroids via this process. And we think kind of the preferred critical size for this is right around 100 kilometers. And this is, you know, corroborated by lots of observations through the solar system. This is kind of the preferential size that the streaming instability forms. And so this is a video of this process made by a guy named Anders Johansson, who's one of the key people in coming up with the streaming instability. You're basically looking, you know, at a box that's orbiting along in the gas disk. So you're in the rotating frame, and you're seeing, you know, these filaments of mass, these red overdense regions that start to form, and then they hit that critical, you know, level of concentration, and boom, they form planetesimals immediately. So this is how you get past the meter barrier, and you can form, we think planetesimals started to form in the solar system, you know, more or less right after the sun formed. So just in the first, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of years, we think planetesimals started forming. So once you get to the mass of a planetesimal, you can grow through two different ways. If you are a 100,000 kilometer object in a sea of a lot of other 100,000 kilometer objects, things hit each other, and you can grow by running into other planetesimals. And this is fairly efficient. It's efficient enough to grow things, you know, the mass of the moon or the mass of Mars, about where Earth is within the life of the gas disk. So you're looking at here time lapse of a simulation from another seminal paper in the late 90s. You put a whole bunch of planetesimals down in a computer simulation. You know, this is just zoomed in on a narrow annulus right around 1 AU, right where the Earth is. And just, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, you start to grow these planetary embryos, these moon to Mars mass embryos, just by planetesimals running into each other. You can also grow, if you're a planetesimal, by accreting other pebbles that didn't go through the streaming instability. So, if you are a planetesimal, you've beaten that meter barrier problem. Now you're at a more, you know, favorable drift rate, so you're kind of staying where you are. So now you're basically orbiting with this rain of pebbles that are spiraling in towards the central star, and it turns out, you know, it's much more efficient. And much easier to accrete a pebble than it is to accrete a planetesimal, because you are much more massive than it is, and you're much, much less likely to scatter it when you have an encounter with it. So, if the flux of pebbles is sufficient where you are as a planetesimal, you can grow actually fairly quickly. Just by accreting all the headwind or the rain of pebbles that are spiraling into the central star. So through these two processes, we can grow these planetary embryos, these moon to Mars mass embryos within the life of the gas disk close to the central star. Turns out as you get further out, planetesimal accretion is slower, even into the asteroid belt. You can, you know, grow things the mass of the Earth in the asteroid belt just by planetesimal accretion and pebble accretion, but it takes more like tens, 20, 30, 40, 50 million years, whereas you can do it within the life of the gas disk around where Earth is. After the gas disk goes away, growth does not stop. So this is a computer simulation. That is similar to the types of simulations that I do. I might play this twice to talk about it a couple times. This is kind of the canonical model for the formation of the solar system's terrestrial planets. If you start in a numerical integration with, you know, a sea of planetesimals and embryos that extends, from where Mercury is to where Jupiter is. They will smash together in the absence of gas over, 100 million years or so, and it is very efficient at forming four planets about where they are, the current planets are today. And the nice thing about this model is that it is, consistent with our kind of best inferred formation time for the Earth Moon system. So we think the Moon formed in one of these giant embryo impacts, and our best estimates on the time at which that happened is somewhere around, 30 to 100 million years after the sun formed. 50 to 60 kind of seems like the sweet spot now that we think this happened in. So if we play this one more time, you'll see, gas disk goes away. You have this bimodal population of leftover planetesimals and these moon to Mars mass embryos. And they kind of excite. You've seen their eccentricities on the y-axis, and within, time's ticking away, within 100 million years or so, you've kind of mostly form Earth and Venus and Mars and Mercury, and you've got some leftover junk in the asteroid belt. A lot of the stuff in the asteroid belt goes away because of interactions with Jupiter. So there's some problems with this model, which is going to be the kind of focus of the last bit of the talk. A lot of the stuff I've worked on in my own research, but this model is still kind of the preferred model. You form planetesimals in the inner solar system, close to the central star, within the life of the gas disk. That only takes you so far when you're close to the star. But once the gas goes away, these things are kind of released to grow further. And in 100 billion years or so, you can slam enough things together to form the terrestrial planets. If you have enough mass too, you can also form super Earths at close radial distances through this process as well. So to highlight some of the issues with this model that I'll talk about some of the potential solutions for at the end of the talk. Again, this, I mentioned earlier that nature seems to like to form things with similar masses, and that is backed up by these models. So when people started, computers got fast enough to simulate this problem in a reasonable amount of time with a computer simulation. People started running these simulations. No matter how much you kind of even tweak the initial mass distribution, it likes to form four terrestrial planets that are similar in mass. And that's not what we have. Again, Mercury is 5% the mass of the Earth. So this model forms Mercury analogs that are far too massive, and it also forms Mars analogs that are far too massive. Lots of times these simulations, Mars is the most massive problem. So this is known as the small Mars problem. The field's worked on this. There's been a lot of work in the literature on this problem over the last 20 years, not as much on Mercury. It also forms planets in the asteroid belt, of which we do not have one. And there's good reason to believe that there never was one there. If you put something in the asteroid belt more massive than about the moon or so, early on in the solar system's history, whatever gap it carves out, would have persisted to today. You can't kind of refill it. So we should see evidence in the asteroid belt of there ever having been a planet there. And this model likes to form things in the asteroid belt. Another problem too is that the planet's eccentricities are too large. Mercury has a decent eccentricity, same with Mars, but Earth and Venus orbits are near circular, and that does not come out of these models. That's a big problem too. So moving back to our plot here, what about the giant planets? So the red line is kind of meant to be, should have said that at the beginning. Red line is close, you're close to the central star, it's hot. And the blue line is if you're further from the central star. And it turns out, if you're about where Jupiter is, pebble accretion is actually very efficient. So there's still Still a lot of debate in the field as to how giant planets form. As far as the terrestrial planets are formed, as the terrestrial planets are concerned, we kind of don't really care how the giant planets formed. We know they had to be there. We know they had to form within the life of the gas disk. But if you are about where Jupiter is and you are able to, form planetesimals and then planetesimals start accreting. If you're far enough out, pebble accretion is actually much more efficient than it is close to where the Earth is. The pebbles themselves are larger and more massive because things are cooler. There's a lot more solid elements that are able to be in the solid form, right? So you have these big icy pebbles that will, sublimate as they drift closer to the central star, and so pebble accretion is less efficient as they make their way on in. So it's much easier to grow via pebble accretion if you're where Jupiter is, and you can actually grow very, very quickly through this process. And then another consequence of that is once you grow large enough, you go back into one of those regions of parameter space where you're at a mass that lets you move around in the disk. So once you get up to the mass of greater than the mass of the Earth, a few Earth masses up to 10, 15 Earth masses, you could start to migrate in or out in the disk depending on what the thermal profile of the disk is, what the local surface density is. So, well, depending on a lot of properties, things start to migrate around once they get that big too. So this is kind of a key process that we think explains a lot of what happened in the solar system. So once you get large enough beyond that, you kind of reach the threshold for runaway gas accretion. So this is something slightly above the mass of Uranus and Neptune. So we think Uranus and Neptune are kind of stunted Jupiters and Saturns. They didn't quite reach this threshold for to accrete gas directly from the nebula rapidly like Jupiter and Saturn did, or when they reached that threshold, it was the gas disk had almost gone away. But Jupiter and Saturn did. So once you they got up to 20, 30 Earth masses or so, they just started scooping gas directly from the nebula, and they grew to the masses they are today. So what was the state of the solar system when the gas went away? Well, in the inner solar system, as I mentioned, you have this bimodal distribution of planetesimals that haven't, gone into an embryo yet. And these planetary embryos, of which there were, dozens and dozens throughout the disk, as shown in this high-resolution simulation from some of my past work. So you have dozens and dozens of these moon to Mars mass embryos throughout the inner solar system, embedded in a sea of planetesimals. Whereas in the outer solar system, you have giant planets that their orbits are migrating around. What's the consequence of orbital migration? Well, it's a formation of orbital resonances. So there's the preferred configuration of planets that are migrating in a gas disk. So the gas is acting to damp out their orbits, so their eccentricities stay close to zero. They're migrating towards each other, and they can get trapped in orbital resonances. This is one of the most powerful orbital resonances that we think the majority of these giant planets form in, the 3-2 resonance. So this is just when the ratio of the orbital periods of the two planets is 3-2, as I'm sure most of you are familiar with. So we think Jupiter and Saturn are probably formed in either 3-2 resonance or the 2-1 resonance. And these things are stable to perturbation because of the way that the longitudes of the planet's orbits tend to anti-align when they form in these resonances. So they always come to conjunction when they're at the furthest distance from one another. So once they get trapped in these resonances, they stay in these resonances, and they migrate in tandem. And we have evidence that this happens elsewhere. So we think this was the initial state of the giant planets, and this is kind of one of the most famous examples of a chain of resonances between giant planets in HR 8799. And so here you have four planets with orbital periods of first two, 50 and 100 years. So they're in the 2-to-1 resonance. And then 200 and 400 years for planets C and B. So you have this chain of 2-to-1 resonances for what presumably, is the kind of primordial configuration of this system. They attain these orbits in the gas disk. So the giant planets' orbits are not resident now. So they got out of them in some way. So what brought them out of it? Well, it turns out their orbits still, move around after the gas disk goes away. And the reason for that is encounters with planetesimals, particularly encounters with planetesimals in the primordial Kuiper belt. So we'll imagine this Kuiper belt object is a hot potato. So if you are this Kuiper belt object, just in the cold classical Kuiper belt, your dynamics are largely governed by Neptune. The any close approach that you're going to have with the planet is going to be with Neptune. And it turns out Neptune, if you get too close to Neptune, it can do one of two things, right? It can be scattered out and just conserve angular momentum. Neptune's going to move in a little bit, or you can be, handed off inward. You'd be scattered inward onto an orbit where your dynamics are governed by Uranus. And you can, solve this analytically, or you can solve it with a numerical simulation. But it turns out that, given both options, Uranus is more like, or Neptune is more likely to hand things off to Uranus than it is to scatter it out and eject it from the system. Uranus has the same two options, right? It can hand it off into Saturn, move out, or it can eject it. Uranus also is most likely to hand things inward to Saturn. This is still, still true in the solar system today. It just has to do with, the masses of planets and where they are. And then Jupiter's the great ejector of the solar system. Jupiter's most likely to send things on a one-way ticket out of the solar system. So if you throw a whole bunch of things like a massive primordial Kuiper belt at the giant planets, you throw a whole bunch of hot potatoes their way, their orbits are going to diverge over hundreds of millions of years. So this is what kind of tugs them out of their initial resonance. And it turns out that one of the worst configurations to be in is not in resonance, but near resonance without anything like gas to damp your orbit out. So if you integrate this process with a computer simulation, you have the orbits of the giant planets with these circles. We also put a couple extra ice giants in there too. And that the points here are all the Kuiper belt objects that they're all thrown around everywhere. In just a kind of short amount of time, the giant planets get tugged out of their resonant chain. They get into this very unstable configuration, and the whole system kind of blows up. I'll play this again, and you eject giant planets. You have scattering events between giant planets. They come in, their orbits evolved chaotically and rapidly in just, thousands, hundreds of thousands of year time scales. Go backwards. I'll play it one more time. So kind of the preferred, nope, wrong way. And now it's going to make me watch this whole thing again. So this is what's known as the Nice model, as in Nice, France, with some fellows came up with it in the early 2000s. So this is what we think happened in the outer solar system after the gas disk went away. The giant planets, we had five or six of them, a couple extra Uranuses and Neptunes that get ejected, and they reach this state where they fall out of resonance, and they go through this instability, scatter stuff all over the solar system. They have close approaches with one another, and then finally they reach a more stable configuration, which is what we see them in today. So the reason we like this model so much is that it explains a lot of the things that we that a lot of peculiar facets of the solar system, let's say. So obviously it's the ultimate consequence of, resonant chain formation, planetesimal driven migration. This is kind of what we think has to happen to these systems. It's very unlikely, actually, that they stay in resonance and do not go through an instability. That's why we see so many giant planets with these very eccentric orbits. It explains the, eccentricity and orbital period distribution in the outer solar system. You can get these unique, kind of three-body geometries that allow for a regular satellite capture. So when you have like two giant planets that are getting close to each other, any of the Kuiper Belt objects in that kind of general area can have their orbits kind of torqued in a way that allows the irregular satellites to be captured. Also, when the planets' orbits kind of jump in semi-major axis through this instability, that's when they capture Trojan asteroids. As they jump in semi-major axis, they can pick up anything in that semi-major axis range as a Trojan. This explains a lot of the unique aspects of the asteroid belt that I kind of talked about earlier. This evolutionary track kind of explains a lot of the dynamics in the Kuiper Belt, the semi-major axis, eccentricity, inclination distributions. This explains why Mercury's eccentricity and inclination are so large compared to the other terrestrial planets. It's because the Nu 5 resonance, which is a secular resonance with Jupiter's eccentricity vector precession, that ends up through this process slamming right down on top of where Mercury is today. So this explains Mercury's orbit, explains a whole bunch of things. There have been a whole bunch of papers over, the last 20 years or so that we really think this is kind of the consensus model for the solar system. So that's what happened with the solar system. What about all these other systems? So this is kind of, these next few slides are, kind of our best attempt at a unified model for planet formation now. So if you are close to the central star, you form these rocky, smaller things. If you're far from the central star, you form these larger, pebble accretion's more efficient. You form these larger, icier, planetesimals and giant planet cores, right? Pebble accretion is much more efficient. So you're able to form, these seeds of giant planets, things like 5 to 10 times the mass of the Earth, far from the central star. Close to the central star, you're within the life of the gas disk. You're only forming, maybe stuff the mass of Mars. And this is where things can diverge, right? This is where the solar system went down a different evolutionary path. And the biggest reason, spoiler alert, why the solar system went down its evolutionary path is Jupiter. What's unique about the solar system, we think, is really that Jupiter grew so quickly and did not migrate a lot. So Jupiter got large very, very quick. It kind of stunted anything else, and stunted us from going down another evolutionary pathway. It blocked the flow of pebbles to the terrestrial planets. It prevented them from growing much more massive, and it prevented any of the other giant planets from migrating too far inward as well. But this isn't necessarily the case in a lot of other systems. If you don't grow as fast as Jupiter did, what we think happens in a lot of systems is things grow up to this, 5 to 10 Earth mass core range, and then they start to migrate. They're not just hitting that runaway growth regime where they suck up all the gas from the disk and they carve out a gap in the disk like Jupiter must have. They kind of grow too slow, and they migrate on in, and they stack up to form these systems of compact chains of super Earths and sub Neptunes. So to quickly kind of return to this plot of a whole bunch of exoplanets, how do we get these, four main populations? Well, these Jupiter and Saturn analogs that have large orbital periods, large masses like Jupiter and Saturn, they form quickly. They don't migrate a lot, and most of them experience these instabilities. And that's why the majority of these giant planets have very, very large eccentricities. These are inherited from their post-disk instabilities in the solar system. We're somewhat unique. Our giant planets had a more mild instability. Hot Jupiters, this is probably the least understood. There's several different models for how these things form, but kind of in the context of what would be the Holy Grail to get this whole model working very well, these would be things that form very, very fast and also migrate very fast. So they migrate in, they form out where Jupiter and Saturn are, and they form quick and they migrated in, unlike Jupiter and Saturn. Then again, these super Earths and sub Neptunes, they did not grow fast enough. They migrated on in. Some of them experience instabilities once they get close to their central star. And then things like the Earth, they would think most of them kind of grew where they are. Maybe they were protected by a giant planet like Jupiter. Their growth was stunted because something blocked the flow of material into them, and they probably didn't migrate around a lot, and they didn't go through one of these dramatic orbital instabilities. However, we didn't go through one of these orbital instabilities, but we were an innocent bystander when one went on. What we think now is that the solar system's instability happened, when the terrestrial planets were still forming. I'll play this video one more time. And one of the big reasons for that is if this instability happened when the terrestrial planets were on their fully formed on their current orbits, it is not good for them. There's the giant planets' orbits are evolving chaotically. You have, ice giants that could be making perihelia passages through the asteroid belt before they get ejected. Things are going crazy. Play this one more time. So this is one of these same videos of this NEAS model, but here we have the terrestrial planets in there. And what the video is going to do is after the instability kicks off, things go crazy in the outer solar system. It zooms in on now the orbits of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, gray, yellow, blue, and reddish. And you see Mercury's orbit's super excited, and then eventually Mercury has too many close encounters with Venus, and it gets ejected out of the system. So this is a problem, and a lot of my PhD work was how do we get around this problem? And one of the big obstacles that we kind of had to fight along the way is there's been a big push in the field, and they came up with this instability model for the solar system. It was an aha moment, right? Things get flung all around the solar system when this instability happened. And we had this thing called the late heavy bombardment that people have been trying to explain ever since they brought back all the Apollo samples, and all the basins on the moon all dated back to about 3.9 billion years ago. So what we think is, cratering on the moon or bombardment on the moon followed this solid black line here, where there was a decay in the bombardment and then sudden big spike right around 3.9 billion years. It was aha, like that's when the instability happened. The problem is that that's super problematic for the terrestrial planets. In the last 10 years or so, this has kind of been revised. There's been a lot of work that kind of has refuted this, and now we think cratering on the moon was maybe more like the dotted green line or the red line, where there were several kind of waves of intense bombardment on the moon, and this 3.9 billion year one is just kind of the last record of it. And there's also a lot of other evidence now. Some of it's listed here, I won't go into it, that the instability happened much earlier, probably while the terrestrial planets were forming. So this is what I did for my PhD. We modeled what happens if the instability happens while the terrestrial planets are forming. So here you have, the whole solar system, right? That whole model I kind of talked about. You have the terrestrial planets forming, the instability happening in the outer solar system. We ran a bunch of these simulations, really trying to see could the terrestrial planets survive it, right? Can we end up with four planets and get around that problem where we lose Mercury and Mars whenever we do the instability? And it worked. We were able to form four terrestrial planets, but something that we noticed We also were getting Mars analogs in our simulations, like what's being shown here, that were the right mass, right? We've talked about, and I'll show in this next slide, we had these long-standing problems with our models of terrestrial planet formation, where the nature likes to form terrestrial planets that are all the same mass, and that's not the case in the inner solar system. So if you recall, this is what the classic simulations of terrestrial planet formation looked like, where you form, Earth and Mars that all have about the same mass. Venus and Mercury kind of have the same mass too. That's not the case in the solar system. We also form these nasty planets in the asteroid belt that we can't get rid of. We also have this excitation problem, right? Where here Earth has an eccentricity of like over 0.05, and it's like zero in the modern solar system. So how did we do with respect to the Mars problem? Oh, this worked quite well. Now there's other models out there that aim to resolve the small Mars problem. We really like this solution because the meteorites that we have from Mars indicate that Mars's formation was complete within just a couple million years, whereas we know from samples of the moon that the moon forming impact that completed the formation of the Earth wasn't until 10, 50 times that. So something stunted Mars's growth, and our argument is that it was this instability in the outer solar system. The instability, excites material in the asteroid belt and near where Mars is. That's where the perturbations of the excited giant planet's orbits are stronger, and you remove a lot of material. And so here we're plotting a cumulative distribution of all the Mars analogs that form in a whole bunch of simulations. So in the control, kind of like the classic model, you form a whole bunch of planets that are like the mass of the Earth, and then in the black one, that's our instability simulations. About half of the planets have the mass of Mars or less, and about half are more than the mass of Mars, the vertical line. Then if you plot, on the right, a whole bunch of planets that were formed in a whole bunch of simulations against the masses of the terrestrial planets, the red squares, so mass on the y-axis, semi-major axis, and the x-axis. You see on the top, this is that small Mars problem. You see, you'd like form a whole bunch of Earth mass things out where Mars is, and when you put the instability in there at the right time, the stunt Mars's growth, you get a whole bunch of planets that are the mass of Mars. So the next thing we did was we tried to model this in a more realistic manner. Our initial simulations had all collisions are kind of treated as perfect mergers. Two things touch in a simulation, they become a new object with the mass of the initial two. This isn't necessarily realistic. Things fragment and break up. So in this video, the fragments are colored black, as you see here, overlaid on top of this video, and then the colored things are the other planetesimals and embryos. So when you put the fragmentation in, again with this whole instability model, you have this extra population of all this extra mass, and so you have more encounters with more small bodies, and that can help to damp out the orbits of the growing, particularly Earth and Venus. And it's significant. It gets us to where 10 to 20% of our systems have Earth and Venus with the right eccentricity inclination. It's still a problem. It's still a problem that we're working on. But we think we're going on the right track with collisional fragmentation. So we get, much better systems when we use, a more realistic model for collisional breakup. And then we moved on to the asteroid belt problem. And here's a simulation of what happens in the asteroid belt when the instability kicks off. Let's do that one more time. Whoa, there goes everything. So it turns out, if the instability happens early, before things be able, start to grow and accrete in the asteroid belt, you can wipe out a whole bunch of mass very, very quickly. You can start with, kind of a uniform distribution of material in the inner solar system, where you have a few Earth masses of stuff in the asteroid belt, and you can get rid of it really, really quick if the instability happens early. And it turns out, what's being shown in this plot here, if we take what's called the angular momentum deficit of Jupiter and Saturn. So just a measure kind of their orbital eccentricities and inclinations. We run a whole bunch of different simulations. You get a whole bunch of different outcomes. And when you get, close to the solar system value, the red line, the simulations that fall closest to that, you also get the best match to the asteroid belt's total mass. Oh, I had a little label for that. So yeah, I know I've gone for about an hour here. I have more slides that I'll talk about. I've done a lot of work on Mercury as well, but didn't kind of have time to fit that into this talk. But the main conclusions of the work that we've done on terrestrial planet formation in the solar system, we strongly think that Mars's mass and its formation timescale with re compared to the Earth's is kind of the smoking gun, telling us when this instability happened. The instability happened in the first few million years, less than about 10 million years after the solar system formed, in order to, kind of do all these things for us and explain really why Earth and Mars are so different. Mercury, I've done a lot of work on that as well. I think it's kind of tied to what Earth and Venus did, right after they started to form in the gas disk. We need to do a lot more work on this. Big conclusion from this talk, big problems in planetary science. We still don't understand a whole lot about, how the terrestrial planets formed. We're still missing part of the big picture. What we need to make progress on this is, we need samples from more of the solar system. We really need more data points from the solar system, particularly Venus and Mercury. And yeah, sorry I went to for a whole hour. Thank you for sticking around.
Very nice. Yeah. Great
Thank you, Matt.
work. Great work you're doing there.
Thank you.
So we can take a few questions if we have any. I see David Williams a few minutes ago put a question in the chat. How do you explain the differing orbital planes? Is it based on angular velocity at the time of collision of stellar gases?
The different orbital planes of the planet. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different orbital planes in the solar system. So we're talking the planets themselves, the delta between the solar system's obliquity and the neutral plane of the planet. So that the you know that's a problem too. I guess I'll start with that one. That might be one of the biggest problems in planet formation now, because the difference between the planetary plane and the sun's obliquity is minor in the solar system. There's a whole bunch of different models for it. There's even models where Planet Nine is responsible for that. But in other systems, it's extreme. There's systems that are like totally anti-aligned. And there's some, there's models out there for it, but it's really counterintuitive, and it's a hot topic of research right now. It's not something I work on, but the solar system is not a massive problem there, but other systems really are. The mutual inclination between Jupiter and Saturn is actually well explained by this instability model. And it's well explained by a mild instability. So what I mean by a mild instability really is that Jupiter and Saturn never could have encountered one another. So we think that the planetary encounters happened between the ice giants, or things the mass of the ice giants, and Jupiter and Saturn. If Jupiter and Saturn have a dynamical encounter with one another, you go into that scattering regime that we find lots of exoplanets in, where they wipe out everything. They wipe out the entire terrestrial disk. They wipe out the other giant planet seeds, Uranus and Neptune, and you just end up with a system that just has Jupiter and Saturn with eccentricities in excess of like 0.5, well separated from one another. Jupiter ends up at like 2 AU and Saturn's out at like 20 AU. That could not have happened. Kind of average mutual inclination that we get between Jupiter and Saturn in these simulations that, match other constraints the best is about that, 1 to 2 degrees that we need it to be. So that's not a huge problem. Inclinations in the asteroid belt, moderate problem. The asteroid belt, spans the majority of the allowable orbital parameter space in terms of, inclinations and eccentricities on non-planet crossing orbits. But there's a lot of fine structure in there that we still, work on today. The instability is very efficient at exciting inclinations and eccentricities through the asteroid belt because of secular mean motion resonances that traverse the belt while the instability is going on. So in particular, as the planet's orbits diverge from one another, right, as Jupiter and Saturn's orbits get further apart, and Jupiter and Saturn's everything, it's the majority of the mass, it governs all the dynamics in the belt. As they get further apart from one another, their mutual forcing on each other is less, right? So the locations of important resonances with them is moving because the resonances are getting less strong at different points in the asteroid belt. So these resonances effectively are sweeping across the belt. And so, the resonances that are caused by that, 1.5 degree mutual inclination between Jupiter and Saturn, they sweep through the belt and particularly the inner belt, and those resonances can excite those inclinations. Moderate problem, but not a major problem. Still, we're trying to fine tune things. The Kuiper belt's a whole nother problem. How do you get all the unique, distributions of inclinations we observe in the Kuiper belt? There are a whole bunch of models that do it 90% of the way. So this is a whole bunch of active research now too. So that's, I don't know. That's all I know about inclinations.
Any other questions?
Yeah, there's another one in the chat. Gil, do you want to ask it or your comment?
Yeah, so the proposed evolution of the solar system that had Jupiter most closer to the sun. Can you explain what happened to that model and how the Jovian moons play in the formation process, given that some of their masses, like Ganymede, are larger than that of Moon and Mercury? So there's a couple models out there for Jupiter moving around, and one is still out there. That's called the Grand TAC model. Came out about 2011. This is an kind of the competing model to our model to explain the low mass of Mars. And the low mass of the asteroid belt. So, in that model, they argue that Jupiter formed basically much faster than Saturn. So it started migrating inward before Saturn fell into resonance with it. So Jupiter and Saturn were not migrating together. They migrate inward all the way to where like Mars is today. And at that point, that's when Saturn kind of catches up and catches Jupiter in resonance. And if you fine tune the disk parameters enough, that causes their migration to reverse and they migrate back outward. There's several problems with that model. There's seven problems with our model too. It still could certainly be the case. It does a lot of things very well. It is very, very difficult to get that, reversal in migration to happen and to happen at the right point. That's probably the biggest weakness of that model, but it's still out there. And there were also, maybe 10 years ago or so, there were a lot of propositions of Jupiter forming, much closer to the sun and then migrating all the way out. It's also been models, based off like some of these ALMA observations of Jupiter forming much further out and migrating in. Both of those have problems, and Jupiter forming where it is today has problems. Starting close to the sun and migrating out, it's very, very hard to not wipe out anything that would make the terrestrial planet. So that's the pitfall there. Starting too far out and migrating in, problem with that is you dump too much icy material into the asteroid belt, so you can't explain the ratio of C types to S types in the asteroid belt today, like you're way off. So we kind of can put an upper limit on how far out Jupiter could have formed. There's compositional problems too. With both of them, there's compositional problems with Jupiter forming where it is today. The solution that makes everyone, not too mad is Jupiter forming where it is today. So maybe migrating a little bit, but yeah, all those models are still out there. As for the formation of the Galilean satellites, still active field of research. We think that definitely Jupiter's and Saturn's moons, maybe Uranus's and Neptune's primordial satellites, if they had them, that both those systems got, reshuffled at some point. Uranus's when it was tilted, and Neptune's when Triton was captured. But definitely Jupiter and Saturn's, we think, formed in kind of a circumplanetary disk, kind of a miniaturized version of planet formation. When the gas disk was still around in the solar system. So like in the aftermath of Jupiter and Saturn's accretion. The nice thing about that is that they kind of represent little miniaturized versions of these super Earth and sub Neptune systems. So like the models for how they form are actually kind of similar. One of the big problems with Jupiter is not necessarily replicating the masses. The masses actually work out pretty well. Jupiter's a big guy, right? So you're able to form large moons. The masses work out pretty well in that. Having Callisto not be in resonance is a problem, right? Like we talked about these resonant chains, they like to form and dump all the planets into the resonances, and then if they come out of them, they all want to come out of them. So that's a ongoing problem too. We're just scratching the surface of trying to understand how the giant planet satellite systems formed, and we have four very, very diverse systems, which makes it harder. That answer your question? I see another question there from Dave Martin. Why do we see so few rocky exoplanets? Is this mostly a problem of observational methods, or is there really a paucity of rocky exoplanets? It's tough to say now, right? Because they're hard to detect, right? We're just scratching the surface of our ability to detect, things that mass, things the mass of the Earth, or lower. The fact that we see so many systems of super Earths and sub Neptunes, it does not mean that the rocky exoplanets aren't there, but I just kind of think of it as, if you're on this train track of planet formation, and there's different evolutionary routes that you can go down. They're largely just a function of like how much mass is around, what star type you're around, what the thermal profile of the disk is. And one of these most likely evolutionary routes is, forming these kind of giant planet seeds in these undermassed disks compared to the suns. You form these super Earths and sub Neptunes that are kind of failed giant planets, that there's not enough mass for them to get much further, and then they migrate in and they wipe out that anything that would be forming like the Earth that's close to the central star. We happen to have formed in a much more massive disk that was able to form Jupiter very, very quickly, and that took us down that route. Now, there is a lot of good work out there showing very significant statistical correlations between close in systems with distant giant planets also having close in terrestrial planets or super Earth. So if we're looking for where the rocky planets like the Earth are, that they They probably are in systems like the one that the Earth is in. So we do think, if you went down an evolutionary track like the Earth, where you form giant planets, they didn't scatter off each other, so you had a more mild instability, or you're like, HR 8799 that didn't have an instability at all. We think the rocky exoplanet should be there. So they're there. They might not be around every star, but they're around plenty of them, I think.
Yes, our April speaker, I believe, is a colleague of yours, Kevin Stevenson, who at APL, who will talk to us about searching for rocky exoplanets with atmospheres using JWST.
Yeah, and Kevin is he's the best in the world at this, or one of them. So that, take his word for it when it comes to exoplanets. Don't take mine. I'm not an exoplanet scientist. I just play one on TV.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Matt again.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really
Very
appreciate
nice. Thank you.
having a
This
chance to talk
actually
to you.
sets up our future talks. This is like a nice lead-in to several more talks we have going out farther out this year. Heidi Hamel is next month, then Kevin Stevenson talking about rocky exoplanets and other related matters. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is great. I really appreciate it.
All right, well, it was great seeing everyone, and we'll see.